All right. Good evening, everybody. So wonderful to see you all. I'm sorry that we've had an erratic schedule. Do we do 2 weeks in a row and then it's quiet for 3 weeks? So my apologies, but we're going to get in hopefully this week, tonight, and then we'll meet again for the last time before I go on summer break and summer break, wink, wink, right? When I go on to summer working at camp, we'll have one more session, hopefully on the 4th, on June 4th. All right. But I figured there's no better way to prepare for the holiday of Shavuot than to talk about it and to really appreciate what it is that we're celebrating. So I want to start with a basic question, a simple question, and I'm pretty sure most of you, if not all of you, know the answer to this. God offers the Torah to the Jewish people. Yes, he offers it to the other nations, and at the end of the story, they're not interested. They reject it. But then God offers it to the Jewish people. And perhaps what goes down as the two most famous words that were ever uttered by a people in a relationship, these two words were uttered by the Jewish people that changed the course of history. What were those two famous words in Hebrew? In English, obviously, it's more words. But anybody know what those two? Naaseh v'nishma. In English, it means we will do and we will listen. That's literally the translation. We will do and we will listen. Why were these such a monumental expression? What was so fantastic about it? Is because it's illogical. The ordering makes no sense. If you come to me and you say, hey, Rabbi, you know, can you do me a favor? If I were a smart guy, I wouldn't commit to it and say, sure, no problem. Now I'm stuck because I don't know what you're going to ask of me. Maybe you're going to ask that I don't go to camp this summer and that we keep doing this no matter what. And we switch to a every week kind of class. I don't know if I can commit to that. What would have been smarter to say is Nishma, we will listen. Let's hear what it says. And then, okay, I like it. Naaseh, we will do it. That would have been the logical way to say it. But that's not what the Jewish people did. They did it the other way. They preceded Naaseh, we will do it, and Nishma, we will listen. That's why it's so phenomenal. It's a secret. The Talmud says that God said when he heard the Jewish people respond with that expression, preceding we will do to we will listen, God said, who told them about this secret like the angels? The angels have that mentality. The angels, they commit. They just say, whatever you ask, God, we're your spiritual robots. We will do. Now tell us what we need to do. God said, who told human beings to speak that way? That's an amazing expression. How credible it is. Listen to a Talmud. Listen to a piece of Talmud. Rav Simai taught, at the moment the Jewish people answered Naaseh v'nishma, 600,000 angels descended and crowned each Jew with two crowns, one for Naaseh, one for we will do, and one for Nishma, one for we will listen. It was such an expression that God says, I give you two crowns of wow. You guys are the best. Why 600,000? We've had the opportunity to speak. 600,000, we had in yesterday's Torah reading, right? The census that was taken. The men between the ages of 20 and 60, they numbered 603,550. In general terms, we say 600,000. So each Jew was represented there. Each one of them got not one, but two crowns. Jimmy, right? Shows how much of an incredible monumental expression it was, right? Hmm? You're good with this? You shouldn't be. You should not be comfortable with this at all. I'll tell you why. I understand that God is impressed with the fact that we said we will do. And therefore, he gives us a crown. Give us a crown for the fact that we said we're committed. We're going to do it. So good, you get a crown for that. But why do they deserve a crown for Nishma, for we will listen? That's just a result of having committed. Now you have to hear the instructions of what it is you're committed to. You don't deserve any extra credit. That's like coming to me and saying, will you do this favor? And because you guys are my friend, I'll say yes. So that shows how much our relationship is, and I trust you and you trust me, and great. But then you have to give me the instructions. I don't deserve any great credit and praise for the fact that I then say to you, okay, what do you want me to do? Duh, that's obvious. So why does God feel so impressed that he goes ahead and gives us a crown, not just for we will do, but even for we will listen? It's a given. No extra credit deserved there. Right, counselor? You ever heard that question before? Guess not. Steve, it's a good question. You like the question?
There you can.
You don't like the question?
Well, you don't want to just be robots and do what you're told to do. God wants us to learn the Torah to create a relationship with God. So when we say we listen, we'll listen mean that we will listen, we will learn, we will become closer to Hashem.
But that's what Nasa is. What did you commit to?
Nasa is just do. You can follow the orders or the mitzvahs without understanding it or learning it.
Okay, so you're suggesting that nishma doesn't mean just listen to the instructions. You're saying right. You're taking it deeper, that we are committing ourselves, and we're not just going to do a checklist. Okay, there's davening, there's tefillin, there's kosher, done, check. But rather something much greater, much more than that. And that is we delve into it and understand it and find deeper insights. That's how one group of commentators do understand it. So that's, I will accept it. That's a good answer. But I want to, anyone else have a suggestion? Because now I want to share this other thought with you. And the way to appreciate this is I got to tell you a story that happened the other day. I'm driving along, and out of nowhere, I see out of the corner of my eye, two squirrels. You've all had this experience. Two squirrels that all of a sudden dart out into the middle of the road. Now watch what happens here. Don't get nervous. It has a good ending. Don't worry. Okay. The first squirrel goes flying across and he sees the car and he zigs and he zags and he works it and he makes it across the street and he scampers up the next tree. The second squirrel, well, different story there. He darts out into the middle of the road, sees the car, and all of a sudden he goes, this isn't a good idea. And he starts heading back. Oh, no, there's another car coming in that lane. So he zigs and he zags and he's passing, and he almost gets run over by a third car. And it's just like, poor squirrel. But ultimately, he does make it across the street and he joins his friend who's probably laughing his head off. The difference between these two squirrels, we're going to come back to. But I believe that the answer to our question is going to come down to understanding the story with the squirrels. But let's delve a little bit deeper before we come back to this squirrel. Okay? Let's talk about the following. There's a Mishnah we learned once upon a time when we learned Pirkei Avot. Beautiful Mishnah, but very difficult to understand. The Mishnah reads as follows. And who am I going to put on the hot spot here? Brad, you're on the hot spot this time. Sorry, buddy. Okay, listen to this Mishnah. The Mishnah says like this. Rabbi Chama, the son of Rabbi Chanina said, Here it is. Rabbi Chanina used to say, anyone whose actions exceed his wisdom will endure. But anyone whose wisdom exceeds his deeds, his wisdom will not endure. That's what the Mishnah states. I'll say it again. Anyone whose deeds are greater and exceed his wisdom, then his wisdom will last. His wisdom will endure. But if it's the opposite of where his wisdom exceeds his actions, then his wisdom will not last. His wisdom will not endure. You understand that, Brad? It's clear as day to you? Not at all, huh? What bothers you about it? Huh? Here, do you want me to? Here, I'll ask to unmute here.
Thank you.
There you go. So what don't you, what's the difficulty?
Well, I think the wisdom of being Jewish or doing mitzvahs is action. So your wisdom, by action, your wisdom endures? Is that what he said?
The phraseology is, anyone whose actions, whose deeds exceed his wisdom, then his wisdom will endure.
Right, because mitzvahs aren't, they're more than just thoughts, they're actions. I mean, you know, you got to do something, not do something to I guess continue this wisdom by action.
So then let me ask you a question though, cuz I still find that very difficult. How can a person do something if they don't have the knowledge what to do or how to do it? How could you ever have a situation of where one's actions can exceed their wisdom? It doesn't make any sense on the surface. You're going to ask me to do something, or I decide I'm going to do something. I only know how to do it up to a certain point. Then my actions can't be more than what I know. How do I do more than what I know? That's impossible.
Well, that's like you can't do anything by just having the thought. You have to have the act. So I don't
disagree with that. I don't disagree, but this is more than just thoughts. This is saying your knowledge, your wisdom, what you understand. If your actions are greater than what you understand, then everything will be great. But if your actions are less than what you know, meaning you know more, but you don't do it, then even what you know is going to fall away. I'm okay with the second half. I'm having trouble with the first half. How could I possibly have more deeds greater than I know? If I only know how to bang, oh, I'm sorry, here, I'll give you an example. What if I only know how to use a flathead screwdriver? That's all my knowledge is. I know how to use a flathead screwdriver. And all of a sudden, someone gives me a Phillips head screw. Right? How could my actions of putting in that screw, I don't know how. I don't know what a Phillips head screwdriver is. How could my deeds ever exceed my actions? That's my problem with it.
Your deeds exceeding your
wisdom. How can that be? I don't know it. How can I do it?
I think just by doing it, you're exceeding your wisdom. If you have some,
that's called trial and error.
Well, it gets better, easier after the first time.
Okay, that's true. That is true. And that is, yes, we should not be limiting ourselves to only what we know. We have to go out of our comfort zone sometimes. That is true. But it sounds like this mission is telling me a general principle, not so just someone, a one-off, a one unique situation.
What, Jim? So someone says, don't eat a cheeseburger. Yeah, all right, I won't eat cheeseburgers. But you don't know why. You don't know that it says in the Torah you don't mix milk and meat. So is that a deed without knowledge, without wisdom?
Is that I can live with that. I can live with that. I'll prove you right. It's much more fun proving you wrong, but I'll prove you right. Here. When we put on tefillin, Jim, right? When we put on tefillin, we know that there's the arm tefillin and the head tefillin.
Right.
What's the order? I think we've talked about this. What do? We put the arm tefillin on first, then we do the head tefillin. But when services are over and we take off our tefillin, we do the opposite. We take off the head tefillin first and then the arm tefillin. It's called LIFO, last in, first out. Us computer geeks, right? Jews are anal. Jews follow. We are OCD. It's just in our DNA. You know, DNA and OCD for Jews, they're synonymous. It's the same thing. Why do we flip the order? It should be first in, first out. Put on the arm, put on the head. And when we're finished, take off the arm, take off the head. That's what I would have suggested as tefillin, but I'd be wrong. There's a profound lesson in the order in which we do it. Arm represents action. You do things. Your hands are what does the action. Your head, that's the wisdom. That's your knowledge. That's your understanding, your comprehension. Let's go through it step by step. You have the Jew, he's about to put on tefillin. And he puts on the arm tefillin. Stop. Take a picture of him. What do you have? You have a picture of a Jew who's got action. He's got the tefillin on the arm, action, but doesn't have the knowledge, doesn't have the comprehension, doesn't understand why. Okay, go to the next step. Now you put the tefillin on the head. Now you have a Jew who's got action, who's questioned and wants to understand. Now there's wisdom. Now there's an understanding. What if I do it the opposite? Now when I take it off, I would take off the arm tefillin, stop, take a picture of it. What do you have? You have a Jew who has knowledge, knows what Torah is, knows what the Torah is asking of us to live a certain godly life, but there's no action. It doesn't lead to anything. It remains purely academic. That, no, no, no. That's not legit. To have someone who doesn't action, who doesn't yet understand, Jim's right. That is an acceptable mode. Don't remain only with action. Push yourself. Try to understand. But to go ahead and to have the wisdom and never translate it into an action, into a deed, then even the wisdom is never going to endure. So Jim is right. Jim is right. That is how some understand that Mishnah. Well done. But I want to share with you something that Rabbeinu Yonah was one of the early commentators. He lived at the time that we call the era of the Rishonim, the early commentators. I'm talking about Rashi, Maimonides, Nachmanides, all people of that generations, those couple of hundred years, they are called the early commentators. Rabbeinu Yonah is one of them. He wrote his commentary on many things, but the one on Pirkei Avot is a classic. It's a classic work. And he understands this Mishnah slightly differently. And that, I think, will bring us back to our squirrels shortly. Rabbeinu Yonah says that what's really happening in this Mishnah is that, I left off one piece, and that in that Mishnah, it brings the proof that when your actions precede the wisdom, or exceed the wisdom, that it will endure, and the proof of it is, because the Jewish people said, Nase v'nishma. How did that prove anything? So listen to what Rabbeinu Yonah says. He said the word na'aseh, which we have translated till this moment, for the first 30 minutes of this class, we have translated the word na'aseh as we will do. He translates it slightly differently. We commit to do. You say, well, that's really what it means. Listen carefully. Rabbeinu Yonah says that it's the commitment to do it that determines everything going past, everything that follows. When you commit to doing something and you put your heart and soul into it, that will give you the resources to then accomplish it. The decisive factor in whether you will be successful in your mission or not is how well you committed to it. Think about your own experiences. When you made up your mind, whether it was in your job, with your family, a particular project you were working on, if you made a sincere commitment to do it, you get the strength and the wisdom and all that you need to make it happen. You will find a way to get to that goal. If you commit to it half-baked, it sounds right. Yeah, I mean, I'm interested. Doesn't always happen. They tell a story. I'll tell you my version of it, the way I heard it in high school and what I recently found, but it's the same story. I heard the story of the difference between that you're interested in accomplishing versus I'm committed to accomplishing is the difference between cream cheese and lox. Cream cheese, the cow is interested because the cow just has to give the milk and the cow goes on his merry way. But the lox, the fish has to be all in. The lox, he's in or out. He's committed to this. Right? The difference between I'm interested and I'm committed. Recently, I read the similar story of where a chicken and a pig who've been on this farm for many years. They were talking one day, and they decided, you know what? The farmer has been really good to them for these years. They should do something nice to express their gratitude. So they decide, you know what he'd appreciate is a nice hot breakfast. Nice hot breakfast. Like, that's what we should do. Okay, so what should we make for him? So the chicken says, I know he would love fresh scrambled eggs. Fresh scrambled eggs would be so good for him. He'd really appreciate it. Oh, that's a great idea. Okay, what else? I think we should get freshly squeezed orange. Oh, great idea. One more thing. It needs one more thing. You know what? He would love fresh bacon. That's what he would love. Fresh bacon. Obviously not a Jewish farmer. Okay. Right? Fresh bacon. And the pig is like, yeah. Hold on there one second. You're interested in giving fresh eggs. I got to be all in for this one. If he wants bacon, it's right. That's the idea. When the Jewish people said, Naseh, it's not just, yeah, we will do it. Now tell me what needs to be done. It's the fact that we preceded with the words and the commitment that no matter what, I'm going to do what you ask of me, God, in the Torah. Therefore, the result is Nishma. We will listen and we will accomplish. It's the fact that we preceded the commitment before listening to what it is that it entails that gave us the push, that gave us the resources and the extra X factor, if you want, to accomplish it. That's what Rabbeinu Yonah writes. And that's why it says, somebody whose deeds doesn't mean he actually did it yet. Someone who commits to doing it, even though he doesn't yet understand what it all entails, then yeah, he will figure it out because he's committed to do it. This is the primary difference between an amateur and a professional. There's a guy named Eric Kruger. He's a mental coach, an author. He speaks around the country. He founded something called the Mental Performance Lab. Came across it not that long ago. I want to read you his quote. So perfect. He says, true commitment is the ultimate determining factor of whether you will be successful or not. All other positive attributes that we usually assign to great entrepreneurs, like perseverance, focus, resilience, they all stem from commitment. You make up your mind. I'm committed. You'll find a way to make it happen. You tell a great story about one of the teammates of Kobe Bryant. Should I say Olav HaShalom? I don't know. Whatever. Okay. The great Kobe Bryant, for those who don't know, great basketball player, probably one of the best of all time. One of his teammates was being interviewed, and the interviewer was commenting about, you know, like, what's your typical day? I mean, and how much practice do you do? He said, I get up very early and I'm at the gym by 5 for sure, maybe 4. I'm there and I practice. I do rep after rep. I do my foul shots. I take hundreds of foul shots and my 3-pointers and my layups and I spend hours and hours every day because I want to be the best. He says, wow. The interviewer says, that's amazing. What an incredible work ethic. He says, yeah, it was okay. The interviewer was surprised. Like, what do you mean it's only okay? I mean, that's a serious commitment. Why do you sound like it's only okay? He says, because every morning when I got there at 5, Kobe Bryant was already there. That's the difference. That's the difference. For Kobe Bryant, he made himself a commitment that says, I want to be the best. I don't care what it's going to take. I'm committed to being the best in basketball. I am all in. That's the difference. When you make up your mind and you really make a commitment, you'll find a way to get it done. I don't mean anything disparaging. I really don't mean it in any way, shape, or form. Thank God I see wonderful people here. But I would say, and I think you'd agree with me, that the concept of commitment in a marriage or a commitment in a relationship has fallen down a few notches from what it used to be. Again, there are circumstances where a relationship does fall apart and they have to separate and divorce. I get it. But in the younger people's minds, commitment just means while it's still convenient. If it gets hard or it gets inconvenient, well, oh well. That's not a commitment. A commitment is we're going to figure it out. Again, it doesn't always work, but a commitment means you're all in. I'll show you where this plays out. It's so fascinating. Let's go back to Passover for a minute. Passover. The Jewish people are enslaved in Egypt. Right? They're there for hundreds of years, and finally God says the time has come to take the Jewish people out. But the truth of the matter is they didn't have a lot of merits in their favor. They had really become very much ingrained and assimilated into Egyptian culture. So much so that God had to give them two mitzvos, two commandments, to at least give them something that he can say, you've shown me that you're interested, you showed me you're committed, I'll take you out. What were those two mitzvos? Anybody?
Sacrificing the lamb and putting the blood on the post.
Okay, that's one. That's one. The whole ritual involving the Korban Pesach, the Paschal lamb. But tied to that was a second mitzvah. I'll give you a hint. You weren't allowed to eat from that unless you fulfilled something first.
Circumcision?
Yes, that is correct. You had to be circumcised. Bris Milah. Those were the two. It's a law, you know, even in the times of the temple. Somebody who was uncircumcised was not allowed to partake of the Paschal lamb, could not be part of the Korban Pesach. Okay? Two questions I want to ask you. Why specifically these two mitzvos in particular? And to make it matters worse, are those positive commandments or negative commandments?
Positive.
They are both positive commandments. You are to circumcise yourself to partake of it. You have to bring the Paschal lamb. Those are positive do mitzvos.
It's a contract, the covenant. Okay,
it is a contract, but watch what happens here. Here's a general rule. Many of you may not be familiar with this. We know that when it comes to negative commandments, it's much harsher. Meaning if a person violates a do not in the Torah, the punishment is more severe than if you had just neglected from performing what you should have done. Typically speaking, a person violates a negative commandment, there are harsh punishments. For example, you can get lashes. In the time when we had a Sanhedrin, a person can actually get flogged. A person can get lashes for violating a negative commandment. A person, God forbid, if the sin was even more of a had a greater level of severity, then you can even have who dat? No, all right, that's Aaron. What do you call it? If it's a negative commandment, you can even get something called karet. Karet is where your soul gets cut off in the world to come. That's a serious punishment. But 99.9% of the time, those severe punishments, and there's capital punishment also for violating a negative. There's no capital punishment for not doing a positive. A person who neglects, for example, a person who neglects to shake lulav and esrog on Sukkot, There's no lashes, there's no karet, there's no capital punishment. You neglect it and there's a little black mark that you got to deal with, but the severity is much lower. There are only two exceptions. Two positive commandments that have, if you don't perform them, they have the punishment of karet, of being cut off from the Jewish people in the world to come. You know what the two are? The two you just said, Jim. Korban Pesach, the Pesach offering, and Bris Milah, circumcision. Those two are musts. Okay, we don't have the the Pesach offering today, we have an exemption, right? It's like, you know, we got an exemption. What was it called for the draft? Whatever. They had a term for deferment. You got an exemption, whatever, right? So nowadays, we don't have the Pesach offering because we don't have the temple. Fine, right? But Bris Milah is still in play, and that's why we make such a big deal about it, that everyone should have one. But here's my question. They are the only two positive commandments that have that punishment. What is so great? I get Bris Milah. I get circumcision. To me, I get it. That is like the covenant of all covenants. This is Abraham from day one. This is like setting the tone for who we are as a people. But I'll whisper it, even though it's being recorded and they'll hear me no matter what, right? But the Pesach Korban, okay, it's a nice thing, but okay, I can think of things that I would have put a little higher up on the list. Really? Not bringing the Korban Pesach? Oh, it's a commemoration of the Exodus. Yeah, so is 75 other mitzvos. You hear my problem? Like, what is so unique about these two? I got to tell you this. You talk about commitments. That's our topic for tonight. The commitment that we're going to do it. There's two kinds of commitments here. Right? To commit to something could be on an individual basis. My commitment to you personally. You and I have a relationship. I commit myself to you. It's true in a marriage, true in a relationship. You commit that that is going to be between us on an individual level. That's circumcision. Circumcision, we know, was commanded to a single individual, Abraham. We are continuing that practice. A one-on-one. That's between me and God. That's my mitzvah. That's my contract. Someone used that word before. That's my commitment. I'm all in my relationship with God, and I'm going to brand my body and say, yes, I'm committed to you. That's circumcision. But there's another level of commitment. And you all know this. You all grew up hearing Rabbi Stavsky talk about this every single year. And that is, you also have to have a commitment to the Jewish people. You have to be committed to the entity known as Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, not just as an individual. This is the commitment to God as part of the Jewish people. You can't do this on your own. For a Jew to be the full extent of what it means to be Jewish, you cannot do it by yourself. You have to be part of a community and commit yourself to be a part of that community. That's the mitzvah of the Pesach offering. You know, it's a unique law. The unique law is that nobody could have eaten it all by themselves. You had to get together with other people because it was a sheep. It was a decent sized animal, and it had to have been eaten all by midnight that night. I don't care how much you like brisket. There's no chance in the world you are polishing off pounds and pounds and pounds of brisket in one night. There's no way. So by definition, when the Torah tells us that you have to bring a Korban Pesach, you have to bring a Pesach offering, you have to get together with others. It's a given. Much of the tractate known as Psachim, which deals with Pesach, talks about the concept of how the groups are formed. And what if somebody was part of group one and they thought he was part of that and then he ended up in another group? But you got to be part of a group. There's no way to do this all on your own. So intrinsically, the two mitzvos that are given to us as a people before we leave are the two mitzvos that scream, are you committed to A, me, God, individually, you and me? That's circumcision. And number two, are you committing yourself to be a part of the Jewish people? That's Korban Pesach. Once you have that nailed down and you're committed to it, God says, now we can move forward and I can come to you and offer you a Torah. And when you stand and your response to me is, Naseh v'nishma, I commit myself to this, God says, I know you're good for that. That's a real commitment. I've seen you did it 7 weeks ago. You're real. Because that's what a commitment means. I'm in. That's why these are the only two positive commandments, right? The only two that are positive commandments that actually have such a severe punishment for not doing it. It's not just another mitzvah. It's not just another commitment. It is the underpinning of our relationship. It's the commitment. It's like, these are my wedding vows. This is it. This is what I commit myself to. Yeah, can you ignore that? You neglect that? It's not just, oh, I didn't do that mitzvah. The whole underpinning of our relationship depends on it. Both individually, us to God, and us to God through the Jewish people. This is the difference between, as I said before, amateurs and champions. That's the difference. Again, I love to look around. What's out there? How much do we know? Listen to this. There's a guy who wrote a huge article, and he talks about champions. Champions, they make do or die commitments. I want to read you a paragraph about the difference, and listen to his wording. It's so perfect. He said, if there was ever one word that defined the champion, the word would be commitment. When everyone else is tired, exhausted, burned out from the battle, the great ones are just getting warmed up. It's not that they don't fatigue, but their commitment to their dream keeps them going. I love this next line. Average people think it would be nice to achieve their goals, as long as it doesn't get too uncomfortable or painful. Champions don't recognize pain because they've made a commitment to do what it takes to win. Amateur performers make a commitment and approach it like a hobby. Professional performers make a commitment and approach it like a war, knowing that they will have to endure an unknown level of suffering along the road to victory. Amateur performers always question the price they have to pay for success. Champions pay whatever price it takes to win. This small difference in mental strategy makes all the difference in the world. Commitment is more about making a decision to do whatever it takes to succeed than anything else. Yet only the pros seem to be able to get themselves to make these decisions. It's a powerful paragraph. We approach it, yeah, I'd like to do it, you know, but it's a hobby. If it's just a hobby, so then when it gets too hard or too expensive or too difficult or too time consuming, you move on. You put it aside. I'll get back to it. You know how many projects I have in my garage that I would get back to? Yeah, because I wasn't fully committed. If I'm committed, I'm going to make sure it gets done. When we approach the holiday of Shavuot, what is it? Okay, we're commemorating. We got the Torah. No, that is not what it is. It's we got a one-year lease on our connection to Torah. It only lasts for 1 year. And the landlord wants to know, are you going to re-sign for another year? Are you committing to this or not? Is this Torah thing going to be a part of this next year for you or not? Are you committing? Show me you're committed. You know, the Jewish people messed up. The actual night before we got the Torah, they went to sleep. They slept the night before the giving of the Torah. And the Midrash says they slept late. This is one of the sources of why we stay up all night learning Shavuos night, to make up for that mistake. That level of commitment, come on. If you anticipate something and you can't wait for it, you have trouble sleeping. How can you sleep? Oh my God, we're going to Shoresh tomorrow, right? All right, Disney. Yeah, you can't sleep the night before. It's so exciting. I can't wait. Yeah. Jewish people went to sleep the night before. How did you sleep? We stay up because we are solidifying our commitment. But how much do you want it? How much do you really want it? That's really the question. How many of you have a stockbroker or somebody who helps manage some money? I think most of us have somebody who gives us that kind of financial. You in touch with them pretty regularly? right? You don't go years and years without touching base. That'd be foolish, very foolish, right? But you pursue it because, you know, your finances are very important to you. You don't just sit back and let it happen. Do you know King Solomon, and he intuitively understood that that is a major passion of human beings? Listen to what he writes in the book of Proverbs. If you will pursue wisdom like you pursue money, then you will find awe of God. You hear that? If you will pursue wisdom like you pursue money, now you're cooking. Now you're cooking. We call consultants, we call friends, we spend sleepless nights, we're trying to figure out how am I going to get this and how, what's the best return on my investment. And now that everything is so ridiculous, and what's a better investment? Is it the bonds? No, the bond market's crazy now. You can't try. It's so volatile. And we spend time and energy because it's important to us. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be. But don't we owe it to ourselves to at least spend that kind of energy and effort on what is also important to us, our Judaism? At least that amount. That's what King Solomon says. I read once, I'll wrap it up, and you'll understand now why the squirrel makes a big difference here. First I'll tell you the squirrel. What's the difference between squirrel number one and squirrel number two? Squirrel number one made a commitment. He's going to get across this fashtunkana street, and if it means he's got a zig and a zag, I'm going to find a way because I'm determined to get. He has a goal. He thinks that the tree on the other side has better acorns. Whatever his rationale was, but he's committed. He's made up his mind. I'm going to do what it takes. Was there risk involved? Of course there was risk. But he was singular focus. I got to get across. The second squirrel, he also wanted to get across. But as soon as he heard a car, he was like, oh, no, go the other way. No, go that way. This, I don't know which way to go anymore. This way, that way. Who worked harder to get across the street? Squirrel number two. He faced three times the risk that the first guy did. I'm not saying that we should be foolish and just dart out there in life and just jump into things. But there's something to be learned from that squirrel. He made a commitment. He was gonna figure out a way. And that's what we have to strive to do. If we're going to want to say that we're going to celebrate the holiday of Shavuot, the giving of the Torah then is being offered to us now. And all God wants to hear you say is Naseh V'Nishma. I'm committing myself to do it. And now I'm going to go do it. But it's the decision to commit to do it that makes the difference. You've been to a siyum, a completion, when the person finishes a tractate or a particular section of Torah. We celebrate it. And it's called a siyum, S-I-Y-U-M, siyum. And it means to complete, the ending. There's a fascinating terminology that is used. There's a terminology that used when we make the what we call the Hadron, the concluding prayer and thanking God for giving us the opportunity to complete a tractate. We contrast ourselves with the rest of the world. And we say, we toil, we work hard, and they work hard. We run and they run, right? Well, okay, what are we? We run to the world to come. We're running and exerting our toil and effort for the reward, hopefully, that we get, not hopefully, but we will get at the end of time. And what do? They run for stupid things. They run for vanity. They run for this. They run for all these things. Someone asked, who cares what they do? What is the point that I'm going to make a point of saying, this is what they do and this is what I do? They run going the wrong way. I'm running in the right direction. They work hard and I work hard. They work hard just for physical pleasures. I work hard because there's a spiritual. Who cares what they do? Just focus on, thank you, God, for giving me the opportunity to study your holy Torah so that I have a spiritual and a moral compass. And what's that got to do with them? Here's the answer. The answer is that if we want to know how to be successful in our spiritual endeavors, sometimes we have to look at how they toil in their endeavors and how they run towards their goals, their aspirations. Not that I agree with them, but they do it with a passion. They give it their all because that's what their goal is and they want to accomplish it. I should learn from them. Not for the goal is, but the methodology of how to go for it, of how to commit towards their goals. I have to learn from them also. They're right. They have that passion, that drive. I shouldn't use that drive for what I consider to be important. Yeah, that's what I have to learn from them, man. People who go and they stand in line or they camp out the night before Ticketmaster. In the old days, remember, you used to have to stand in line to get tickets to a show or to a World Series or a Super Bowl. And people, or the new iPhone, right? That was a big thing. People would go ahead and they pitch their tents nights in advance. Why? So that they would be there when the store opened in 3 days. I'm not saying that that's the right thing to do, but what you see from them is how much it meant to them, and they were committed to make it happen. And if it means I lost a couple of nights of sleep, so be it. That's what it takes. I'm in. I want it. That's what we have to do. Imagine if you heard that Tuchman was coming to Columbus. You wouldn't stay up all night to hear him? Okay. Maybe somebody else, right? There's got to be a passion. I want to hear this. He's got something I want to. You know what? I'm going to stay up the night before and I'm going to camp out right outside his hotel room so I can be the first one to say, I want tickets to hear what you got to say. People don't do that. Not just for me, right? But that's what it really entails. That's what it entails. This is what the holiday of Shavuos really, really means. What God was so impressed with when he offered us the Torah and we said Naseh before Nishma was because we said we are committed to do it. I'm all in. I want to have that relationship with you. I want to know Torah. I want it to enhance my life. God says, you're committed to it. We can go further. We can grow together here. This is the way to do it. I had one other quote, but that's the punchline. The punchline is that when you make the decision to commit, you're given the resources and the special strength and wisdom to accomplish it. If it's only a half-baked commitment, don't count on it getting it finished. That's what we're being asked to do every Shavuos. Recommit ourselves, become committed. This is the goal. This is what I want. And I stay up all night to do it. That's what we can learn from it. I'm not saying a person has to stay up all night, but that's where the concept comes from, that level of commitment. What do you think? You like it? You don't like it? It brought a new meaning for me into understanding that expression of why God gave us two crowns. What do we do? The second one was, no, it's because we get the crown for preceding and committing ourselves to it, which thereby will lead to its accomplishment that deserves the crown as well. What are you going to say, Jim?
So the Naseh were committed. So the Jewish people at that time said, hopefully that's today, Naseh were committed, Benishma, and we're going to listen and learn and do. I mean, listen and learn so we can. And it was important because it wasn't just we'll do and we'll listen. It's we're committed. God knew we're committed. And then when we said we'll listen also, it was believable because he knew of our commitments.
Is that correct? And we will go through with it.
Yeah.
In other words, again, if they had said we will listen and we will do, we probably would have gotten one crown because that's the norm. Let me hear. Okay, I'm committed. Great, you get credit for that. But the fact that we preceded it with the commitment to do it, that was the decisive factor that then led to its accomplishment. And for that, you get both crowns. That gives you, it's the commitment that makes it the decisive factor in reaching those goals. That's really what's being said here. That's what I'm saying with Kobe Bryant. He was committed. The pig was committed to the bacon. That's it. You're in. And that you get the crown for. Not just for the, you know, for doing it, but for committing to do it that allows that to be accomplished. I find this, you know, to delve deeper each year, to find something new about the giving of the Torah. That whole episode is really, I mean, it's, I don't know, maybe one year I'll do this, and I'll just, a whole year of just looking at that event, the Sinai experience, which really was the most transformative historical event ever. There's so many details and so much that went on there that, you know, it really is worthy of study. It really is. So every year I try to find something a little bit different. No, you got stuck with this one this year. Sorry.
Can I ask you a quick footnote?
Please.
To this?
Please.
So I was with Rabbi Friedman, and we were talking a lot about this. And then he was talking about the burning bush. And I don't know if I have this in the right pretext and time, but he says that the burning bush related to the pain that God was feeling for the Jewish people.
The burning bush is earlier, before the Exodus. The burning bush took place when Moses, let's just put it in context. It's a good question. Moses grew up in Egypt, right? He was an infant. He was saved. The daughter of Pharaoh took him in. He grew up in the palace. Fast forward. He kills an Egyptian. Ultimately, he has to run away, becomes a fugitive, and he runs to another country. He runs to a country called Midian. And there he marries. There he works for his father-in-law, Jethro, Yisro. And while he's out shepherding the flock many, many years later is where he comes upon the burning bush. And where God comes to him and says, the time has come. The Jewish people have cried out to me. I feel their pain. Now I'm going to send you to take them out. And that's the Exodus. But what you're touching on, Rabbi Friedman was referring to, is why a thorn bush? Why, it could have been a beautiful evergreen. Why? Because the symbolism of a thorn bush, right? The burning bush was a thorn. It was like prickly. Why? Because God was still, even though it had been years and years, hundreds of years, God was in pain with us. God never really left us. It was much more hidden. It felt, you know, to some degree, it felt it. But God was telling Moshe, I've been feeling this pain for years too. And the time has come. Their cries have reached me and a time has come. That's where I think is the context in which this is. Then it leads to the Exodus, which leads to the giving of the Torah. That's the chronology of it. Any other questions? That's a good one. I like that one. All right. Fabulous. Well, I appreciate everybody taking the time. And we will, God willing, we will meet in 2 weeks. We'll have one last session before the summer. And I have to figure out what topic, but we'll come up with something for a finale. Steve will be happy. We'll find something good.
Thank you so much.
All right, my pleasure, everybody.
All right,
have a happy Shavuos.
Time,
yes, have a good holiday.